How much attention do you pay to your personal brand? Until recently, the idea of cultivating and curating your self-image was a strange one, but the rise of social media has made it common. But it's a habit that has old roots, as documented in the new book, Self-Made: Creating Our Identities from Da Vinci to the Kardashians, by Tara Isabella Burton. Tara is a contributing editor at the American Interest, a columnist at Religion News Service, and the former staff religion reporter at Vox.com. She's written on religion and secularism for National Geographic, The Washington Post, The New York Times, and more. Here she is to share five of her big ideas.
Hello, my name is Tara Isabella Burton, and I'm a novelist, culture critic, and theologian focusing on the relationship between religion and the way we live now. In my most recent book, Self-Made: Curating Our Identities from Da Vinci to the Kardashians, I look at the long, strange history of personal branding and how it's inseparable from the thoroughly modern idea that, as human beings, the most important thing we can do is create our own destinies and make our own reality. Today, I'd like to share with you five key insights from Self-Made. Insight number one. Self-creation is nothing new. Today, over 50% of Americans say they'd be a professional influencer if the opportunity presented itself, and more than 90% say they'd post sponsored content on their social media feeds for cash. But the idea of cultivating and capitalizing on your personal brand is nothing new. In fact, we can trace the origins of the thirsty selfie to the cult of the Renaissance artistic genius, and in particular, to Renaissance painter and self-promoter extraordinaire Albrecht Dürer, a pioneer of the self-portrait in visual art. The earliest self-portraits in Western art history were relatively modest affairs. A painter might, for example, put someone who looked like him in the background of a religious scene. This fit in with the prevailing pre-modern idea of the self as a not very important mortal being whose purpose in life was to be, basically, the background to a much bigger and more important story of God. But Albrecht Dürer changed all that. In his 1500 AD self-portrait, Dürer didn't just present himself as a worthy subject of reflection. He painted himself, basically, as Jesus, in the forward-facing posture with the raised hand gestures typically associated with Christ himself. Smirking like the Mona Lisa, this painted Dürer is a celebration of the artist Dürer's own talent and creative powers. The artist, Dürer seems to suggest, is a kind of God. The human being who creates and chooses is participating in acts typically reserved for the divine. Dürer isn't alone in exploring this then novel idea. The Renaissance, a time of radical social change, including the rise of a new and newly literate middle class, saw an explosion of this kind of humanistic thinking. As artists and philosophers, most of them not aristocrats, but indeed, like Dürer and his rough contemporary Leonardo da Vinci, self-made men, began to celebrate human potential to determine their own lives in accordance with their own desires. In his 1510 manifesto, Oration on the Dignity of Man, Renaissance humanist Pico della Mirandola, later banished for heresy, rewrites the biblical story of Genesis. This time, though, Pico's God offers Adam not limitation on his behaviors, no, thou shalt not eat the fruit here, but rather, says, divine law assigns to all other creatures a fixed nature. But you, constrained by no laws, by your own free will, in whose hands I have placed you, will determine your own nature. Insight number two. The story of self-creation is a story about religion. The idea that humans not only can, but should create their own destinies was hugely significant and controversial from a religious point of view. In the medieval world, Catholics believed that everything, including your social station and place in the world, was part of God's overall plan for you and for all of creation. King or peasant, prince or knight, your social role was part of how God made you, not to be questioned or changed. The Renaissance, and even more importantly, the European Enlightenment, changed all that. While the Enlightenment is often referred to as the Age of Reason, a better title might be the Age of Individualism, as philosophers like Montaigne, Voltaire, Diderot, and Rousseau explored the idea that social life and social roles weren't divinely ordained at all, but merely a function of custom. a dirty word in Enlightenment thought. Custom, they argued, was arbitrary and random, a result of superstition or prejudice. And as a result, customs could be changed. For Montaigne, custom isn't just harmless tradition. Rather, it's what we're left with when we stop seeing the social world as inextricably connected to the natural one, or the supernatural one. Custom suggests that the reason we do things, cut our hair, wear clothing, perform certain actions, is not because we ought to, or because doing so is part of what we were created to do by God. Rather, we do things simply because we always have, with no particularly good reason behind our actions. Throughout his essays, Montaigne asks the same question over and over. Where are we to distinguish the natural laws from those which have been imposed by man's invention? Over and over, he comes to the same conclusion. Most seeming truths or laws about the ways things are, especially when they come to our social lives and identities, are not innate or God-given, but mere accidents of history, which means, Montaigne tantalizingly suggests, that we have the power to change them. Insight number 3. The power to self-create isn't democratic, exactly. For many people, the idea of self-making is inextricably bound up with the narrative of the American dream. Work hard, apply yourself, and no matter where or how you were born, you too can become wealthy and successful. But more often than not, self-makers were understood not as hardworking individuals who pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, but as special, chosen few, selected by God or fate, with innate qualities that allowed them to transcend the limitations put on ordinary mortals, the common herd, or as we might say today, the sheeple. The self-maker was understood as a kind of demigod. His superior qualities, and it was usually a he who had them, something like the very aristocratic titles the self-making tradition evolved to replace, you had to be born with it. In the Renaissance, for example, people talked about the genius using the language of the divine. A few centuries later, in Regency England, people used instead the language of bon ton, literally French for good manners. In context, bon ton meant, well, a certain je ne sais quoi. Elegance, style, grace, or what would later be understood in early Hollywood as it. Bon ton was what separated successful dandies like Beau Brummel, often considered the first modern celebrity, to say nothing of the first influencer, from the upwardly mobile merchant class. Bon ton, like it, was vital in an era where noble birth was becoming less important and money was becoming more important. It was not something, in other words, that you could buy. The idea that some people are simply natural aristocrats and that they and only they have the right to shape their own destiny and rise above the masses remained part of the story of self-making for centuries. In Europe, the 19th century German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche coined the profoundly influential figure of the Übermensch, a kind of spiritual aristocrat whose qualities of strength and will made him able to become, you guessed it, the closest thing to God in a world which, Nietzsche famously said, God was dead. Nietzsche's ideas about natural superiority would become hugely influential on a number of 20th century proto-fascist and fascist leaders, including the Italians Gabriele D'Annunzio and Benito Mussolini, and of course, on Adolf Hitler himself. But even across the pond in America, where self-making was closely linked to the capitalist work ethic, people still believed that self-makers were fundamentally superior beings. In the late 19th century, heavily influenced by pseudoscientific interpretations of Charles Darwin's then-novel Theory of Evolution, plenty of Americans explained the ever-widening gap between rich and poor as the result of, well, some people simply being better than others. As the Yale political scientist William Graham Sumner wrote in the late 19th century, millionaires are a product of natural selection. In this age of winner-takes-all, conniving entrepreneurs could make dazzling fortunes, but ordinary people were blamed for their failures to become the next Carnegie or Rockefeller. Insight number 4. Everyone thinks you should fake it until you make it. For much of modern history, the American and European narratives of self-creation looked a little different. Europeans tended to stress the innate, maybe even magical, quality of the self-creator, valorizing effortless-seeming dandies like Beau Brummel and Oscar Wilde, while Americans, true to stereotype, focused on praising good old-fashioned hard work, even as they blamed the poor for their own perceived failures. But both visions of the self-creator had one thing in common, the idea that if you weren't a genius self-creator, you could still, with a little bit of grit and what circus impresario P.T. Barnum called humbug, make people believe that you were. As early as the Renaissance, writers like Baldassare Castiglione encouraged would-be courtiers to cultivate the quality of sprezzatura, Italian for making difficult tasks look effortless, even if you'd secretly spent hours working on perfecting them behind the scenes. In Regency England, where the cult of the dandy reigned supreme, ordinary readers devoured wildly popular dandy novels like Robert Plumer Ward's Tremaine, Benjamin Disraeli's Vivian Grey, and Edward Bulwer Lytton's Pelham, in which the dandy protagonist treated readers into insights on how dandies lived and how to become a dandy yourself, usually through amoral behavior and careful conniving. Disraeli's Vivian Grey, for example, reads as House of Cards meets Bridgerton, as its young dandy protagonist rises through the ranks of London society by scheming with, quote, a sneer for the world. In America, likewise, the idea of virtuous hard work was soon intimately bound up with a mania for positive thinking, manifesting, and other forms of, well, faking it. In the late 19th century, a quasi-spiritual self-help movement called New Thought, an early version of power of attraction type movements like The Secret today, spread all across the Eastern Seaboard. Central to this new religious mania was the idea that you could control the universe, including your health and bank account, by looking inward, thinking positive, and visualizing your own success. A person is limited only by the thoughts that he chooses, one self-help book from the New Thought tradition states. The outer conditions of a person's life, quote, will always be found to be harmoniously related to his inner state. In other words, wanting money, fame, or beauty badly enough, for the New Thought proponents at least, was the first and most vital step towards actually getting it. And so, positive visualizations, affirmations, and outright lies, all these were less counterfactual fictions than ways of gently nudging the universe to provide you with, as we might put it today, your best self. Insight number 5. In the age of the internet, reality is what you say it is. In the 20th century, the American democratic myth of hard work and the European aristocratic model of inherent specialness fused together in the figure of the modern Hollywood celebrity. As the dawn of advertising culture and old Hollywood alike launched a new breed of self-made icons, celebrity stars, this sense of faking it until you make it only intensified. Advertisers made millions hawking products from face creams to deodorants that claimed to help ordinary people appear as though they had that mysterious it, provided they were willing to fork over the cash. You too can be a celebrity, these advertisements insisted, but you need us to unlock your own unique power. Everybody had the potential to have it, but not everybody had the desire or the ability to harness their own individual specialness in the service of chasing success. What separated the star or the dandy, therefore, from the ordinary person wasn't just having some special or innate quality, but being willing to pretend they did, building what we might call today a personal brand. In the decades after the Second World War, as television, personal cameras, and other technological advances closed the gap between viewer and star, the idea that anybody could become whoever they wanted to be just by wanting it badly enough became more and more prevalent in the American cultural consciousness. Bolstered in part by the notoriety of art scene figures like Andy Warhol and his hand-picked superstars, people who, like Beau Brummel before them, were basically just famous for being famous. This new crop of self-proclaimed superstars believed in a 1970s version of the New Thought Manifesto. Want something badly enough, and want to be somebody badly enough, and it will become true. You really are, in the deepest, truest, and most profound sense, who you want to be. As one of Warhol's contemporaries put it, if you wanted to be an artist, you basically just said you were. Saying and believing you were something or someone was enough to make you the person you claim to be. Today, as the internet further democratizes self-creation, and anyone with an iPhone can post a highly curated, filtered, and Photoshop picture on Instagram, that sense of reality being flexible and what you make it has only intensified. Just think of New Thought's most famous devotee, another one-time reality star, Donald Trump. Heavily influenced by New Thought ideology, Trump's personal family pastor was Norman Vincent Peale, a New Thought guru whose book, The Power of Positive Thinking, had been a bestseller in the 1950s. Trump has made an entire career around gleefully warping public opinion, whether or not the things he claims are based on verifiable truth. But for Trump and those like him, truth doesn't matter. Reality, as Nietzsche and Warhol alike foretold, is nothing but we make it. And the best way to make reality in your image is to shake public perception into whatever you want it to be. As Trump himself put it via ghostwriter Tony Schwartz in his business manifesto, The Art of the Deal, the final key to the way I promote is bravado. I play to people's fantasies. A little hyperbole never hurts. People want to believe that something is the biggest and the greatest and the most spectacular. I call it truthful hyperbole. And in the end, maybe that's what self-making is, claiming the power to reshape reality like a human god by using a combination of hard work and Barnum-style humbug. It's what our celebrities and our entrepreneurs alike do, shaping a public image that reflects not who they quote-unquote really are, but who they most want to be. And now, anyone with a smartphone can do it too. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the book.
Thank you, Tara. That was five big ideas from Self-Made, Creating Our Identities from Da Vinci to the Kardashians by Tara Isabella Burton. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.